Welcome to NucleCast, the official podcast of the Amwha Deterrence Center. Our host is Dr. Adam Laufer, co-founder and vice president for research at the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. The Amwha Deterrence Center is a 501c3 organization ensuring a broader understanding of the nation's strategic nuclear deterrence and its ongoing modernization. Thank you for listening and welcome to the show. The views of the host and the guests are their own.
Welcome back to another exciting episode of NucleCast. Of course, I am your host, Adam Lowther, as always. And today we have a great guest, and I'm talking about Joseph Bosco, who is a former senior Department of Defense official who worked in OSD and was the China desk officer and knows a great deal about China. And he now writes pretty regularly. I see his articles quite frequently. And so you'll see him out there. You can Google his name, Joe Bosco. And he writes a weekly column that you may have seen in The Hill. And so we wanted to have Joe on so that we could talk about China and some of the major security threats that are facing the United States. So with that, Joe, welcome to NucleCast. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Nice to be with you.
So we're living in a world that is fraught with dangers. We've got a conflict in Ukraine. We have a conflict in Israel that, you know, is spiraling. We have a potential conflict over Taiwan that folks are keeping an eye on. We have an Iran that is a dangerous nation that's supporting all sorts of mischief in the Middle East. And, you know, in many respects, this is not the world we lived in even a decade ago. So from your perspective, as somebody who spent a long career working these issues, how do you see the challenges we face playing out and the decisions we're making affecting American success or failure for us, we want a peaceful resolution to these challenges. So how do you see the challenges and then the decisions we're making about them?
Well, it's a very complex and an important and interesting question. You mentioned the time period that we haven't seen this combination of crises in a decade or so. I think that's true in terms of the recent decade, but I go back to both World War II and the Cold War in terms of the multiplicity of the threats that the United States faces. And I believe that uniquely now we have more contemporary adversaries than we had in those crises, and they're coordinating far better than has been true in the past. You mentioned Russia, China, Iran, North Korea is another one. There's clear evidence that these multiple adversaries are coordinating to a certain extent. One thing they all have in common is we are the enemy. We're the great Satan to Iran. We're the enemy to the global hegemon, to Russia and China. And so they each have reasons to coordinate their activities or their policies against the United States. And, you know, Biden likes to use the phrase, we're at an inflection point in history. We really are at an inflection point, and I'm not sure he's up to the task of coping with it. I'm not sure who is right now, but we need to get our policies straight. And first of all, we need to recognize that there is this kind of coordinated threat, that we're not dealing with separate issues in Iran and North Korea and Russia and China. These people are coordinating. They see ways of sniping at us from different angles and weakening our resistance. And I think that they're in some ways succeeding in that effort, that there's a great weariness in the United States and in the West generally to confront multiple challenges. And nobody wants war, as you say, but the other side is willing to risk it far more than we are. And therefore, they're willing to push us to the brink. And you hear Biden, for example, even before the Russians went into Ukraine, saying, we're not going to send troops, and we're not going to do no-fly zones because that's World War III, he said. Well, when you've got that mindset that anything you do is going to trigger World War III, you open the door to the other side, pushing, and you're going to be the one to back down. So we need to find out how we can coordinate in the West, regain a mentality that we are at war, whether it's a shooting war or a psychological and political war. We are being attacked from multiple fronts, and we need to get a coordinated strategy.
Yeah, you mentioned something that I don't think many Americans truly think about, and this idea that, you know, if you go back to Joint Publication 5.0, when we talked about planning, we would have these very clear phases of war. And one of those very clear phases of war that I guess there's sort of this magical point in which you transition from one phase to the next, was there was this clear phase of peace. And we as Americans sort of see peace and war. It's a dichotomous thing. Whereas the Russians and the Chinese, they have no, for them, there is no such thing as peace. There's war, and then there's different means by which you wage war. And so for them, they've been in a very long-term disinformation, misinformation war against the United States that, frankly, I see as being highly successful, particularly now. And I wonder when the American people don't see war as a continuous thing like the Russians or Chinese do, it makes it a lot harder for us to fight it. So how would you try to either, I don't know, redress that, convince the American people that their view might need to change? I mean, or maybe I'm wrong, and maybe it isn't as I describe it.
No, I think you're right. And I think the short answer, which is, as Reagan used to say, simple but not easy, is leadership. The reason the American people and the West generally don't see the danger is because our leaders haven't told them there's this kind of universal danger. And so they need to get the mentality that they had during the Cold War and during World War II. Everyone understood what World War II was about at the time, although for a few years before that, people didn't see the danger. In the Cold War, it was less clear. We weren't fighting and shooting. That's why we got into Vietnam, Korea, and other places where we didn't see a universal threat, so we allowed the enemy, the adversaries, to build their momentum, and then it erupted into a small regional conflict that people said doesn't really concern us. Why should we care about something that's happening in Vietnam? Like Chamberlain said, why should we care about something that's happening in Czechoslovakia? It's so far away from Germany or England. So it comes back to leadership. We need leaders who can mobilize public opinion, educate them on what's really happening in the world, and stop soft peddling it. Keep in mind that our policy for 40 years, 45 years with China has been engagement, that if we simply trade with them and have interactions culturally and otherwise, they'll be more like us. They won't be hostile. They won't be aggressive. That whole, the premise of that whole engagement policy has been proven to be a failure and invalid. So we've got this start change. I think it started to change, frankly, during the Trump administration. He had I hold no brief for Trump himself, but he had a superb national security team that did see the China danger as on multiple fronts. And they started to educate the people. Biden has selectively followed some of those policies, but not nearly enough. And he doesn't relate them to each other. He doesn't see what he's doing in Ukraine, what he did in Afghanistan, affecting how China evaluates the risks and opportunities.
So as we think about China, and we, you know, we think about, there's always a comparison between China and the Soviet Union, and many people will sort of look at the Soviet Union, see it as a sort of this very clear communist ideological bloc, and they'll say, well, you know, it was way more dangerous and problematic than the Chinese. The Chinese aren't quite as ideological. They don't aspire to the destruction of the United States and the, you know, capitalist democracy like the Soviets did. But I wonder, you know, if you look at China, it's much more populous. It's, you know, it's got an economy. You know, the Soviet economy was never more than about a quarter of the U.S. economy, whereas the Chinese economy's, you know, roughly 80 to 90% of the American economy. So it's more people. It's a bigger economy. You know, it's much further away. It's harder to reach out and touch. And so I wonder if we have fundamentally understood the differences between the Soviets and the Chinese, and just how much more difficult of a challenge China truly is than the Soviets ever were.
No, I think that's a perfectly valid and respectable perspective. Of course, we always have to distinguish between the leadership of the country and the people themselves. The Chinese people, I don't think, basically have any problem with Americans. I think there's a certain degree of affection and mutual respect that really spills over from World War II when we were allies. So we have to distinguish between the people and the communist regime. But there's no doubt that the communists in Beijing, whether they call themselves communists or not, and the revanchist leadership, Putin, in Russia, one thing they have in common, as I mentioned earlier, that the U.S. is the adversary. The U.S. is the enemy to be undermined, to be defeated, hopefully without war. I don't think any of them want a world war, a nuclear war, but they sure as heck want to undermine the United States and defeat us in various other ways, gray zone activities, disinformation, misinformation, psychological warfare, economic warfare. So there's a range of ways where they're attacking us, and we need to be able to confront them in each of those. And more than that, I think we need to get off the defensive and start being a little more proactive in each of those areas.
So I've often described Russia, China, North Korea as having an authoritarian arsenal. And in many respects, as I look at the challenge, I see, I would never say that they're a, you know, a unitary actor. I mean, they're friends, you know, I think what Putin said, friends without limits. But I often wonder if the situation were right, would Russia, China, and North Korea act sort of in a unilateral fashion together to coerce the United States? As you look at it with nuclear weapons, do you think that the Russians, the Chinese, and the North Koreans could ever get on board together to try to coerce the United States? Because they you know, if you take them as a, you know, as a group of three, they clearly have a superior nuclear capability to the United States. And I wonder, would they ever work that, you know, collectively, or is that something that they just could never bring themselves to do?
Well, if you're asking whether they would formally or officially declare, in effect, war against the United States and threaten nuclear weapons, no, they're not quite that blatant, but they've come pretty close to it individually. Each one of those countries you mentioned has made nuclear threats against the United States. Putin has done it on Ukraine several times. He said that if the West or NATO intervenes in any way, or if Ukraine does certain things, or if Putin gets the sense that he's losing the war and that his Russian sovereignty is being challenged, he's brandished the nuclear weapon threat. China, on at least four occasions, generals and admirals in China have said things like, you care more about Los Angeles than you do about Taiwan. And they've threatened, one admiral threatened the destruction of hundreds of U.S. cities with nuclear weapons. They throw this out, and of course, it's always deniable. Xi Jinping or someone else would say, well, we didn't say that. He was not authorized to say that. They've done it. North Korea's done it, made threats like that, and it is now building the capability to actually do that, long-range missiles that can reach the United States. So they're not so blatant that they would officially declare war and say we're all going to threaten nuclear weapons attacks against the U.S., but they're doing it in subtler ways, in random ways. But I believe that they do. They have their unofficial coordination when they get together or when their people speak. They all start with the point that the U.S. is the enemy that must be defeated one way or the other.
Now, it's that time in the show where we have to take a quick break, so we'll do that. But when we come back, I'd like for you to talk about this, you know, this fundamental conundrum of Taiwan. And how do you see the CCP's desire for Taiwan and to bring it into the PRC in as part of a controlled by China? How do you see that playing out? And then how do you see the United States and other Asian allies responding to those, to that effort? And so we'll talk about that when we get right back. You're listening to NupliCast.
This episode of NupliCast is brought to you by the Amla Deterrence Center, whose mission is to educate Americans about the nuclear enterprise and strategic deterrence.
And we're back and we're talking to Joe Bosco. And Joe's got a long career in which he worked China for many, many years in the Department of Defense. And so I posed a question to you before the break. So I want to turn it over to you to get your thoughts.
Well, the two words I would use that, and I often do in my speaking and writing, strategic ambiguity. What that means is, the United States has never said, and as so far will not say, that we will defend Taiwan and we will use military force to if military force is used against Taiwan. Now, Biden admittedly has said that four times. But each time he said it, the State Department or the White House has walked it back and said, well, there's no change in U.S. policy. But what, that begs the question, what is U.S. policy officially in terms of defending Taiwan? You have the Taiwan Relations Act in 1979, after the U.S. changed its recognition from Taiwan, Taipei to PRC, and Congress was outraged at what President Carter had done. So they passed the Taiwan Relations Act, which provides that the U.S. will make available to Taiwan defensive weapons to protect itself against China. And it says that we would consider an attack on Taiwan as a grave threat to the peace and stability of the region. But we've never explicitly said we will defend Taiwan as we did earlier with a mutual defense treaty with Taiwan. In 1995, there was a big flare-up in the Taiwan Strait. President Li Dongwei of Taiwan visited his alma mater, Cornell, and China fired missiles to protest this violation of what they consider their sovereignty. The Chinese officials asked Assistant Secretary Joseph Nye what the U.S. would do if China actually attacked Taiwan. His answer, instead of invoking the Taiwan Relations Act, showing that the U.S. had a deep commitment to Taiwan, his answer was, we don't know and you don't know. It would depend on the circumstances. This was a very clever Harvard way of evading the issue. But the problem is, and the rationale is always, well, we're keeping China guessing. Well, we may be keeping them guessing for a while, but we haven't ruled out the fact that we will, under some circumstances, not do anything, not respond to an attack on Taiwan. And so they've been building up their arsenal of anti-ship missiles and attack submarines and various other weapons to deter a U.S. intervention. And just to wrap up that 1995-96 incident, the U.S. sent two aircraft carriers when they resumed the missile attacks or firings toward Taiwan. We sent two aircraft carriers toward the Taiwan Strait. China said if they enter the strait, they will meet a sea of fire. President Clinton turned them around. They did not enter the Taiwan Strait. And since then, we've only had one incident where we sent a carrier through the Taiwan Strait. We do send others in freedom of navigation operations, but we haven't sent a carrier battle group. So the ambiguity is there. China still believes that under certain circumstances, the U.S. will not intervene. And so, of course, they're preparing to create those circumstances that will keep us out.
Now, I've wondered, would it be stabilizing or destabilizing for either Taiwan to develop its own nuclear arsenal or for the United States to station tactical nuclear weapons in Taiwan? Because I don't really know that there's a way for Taiwan to defend itself, even if the U.S. supports it in an effective way that, you know, Taiwan's an island of 25 million democratic, you know, free people, but, you know, its neighbor is much, much larger and doesn't have to travel 10,000 miles to wage war. So I wonder, is there any real solution short of nuclear weapons on Taiwan, or a solution that means Taiwan stays free?
Well, you postulated two different extremes. One is that we do nothing or do little, and the second is that we go all the way to nuclear weapons. I think there is a middle ground. I think we need to articulate again that we will defend Taiwan. I say again because Biden has said it four times, but this time not have it walked back by the State Department and the White House. It needs to be an official, vetted policy of the United States, equivalent in effect to a mutual defense treaty. Now, does that mean nuclear war? Biden will possibly say that, but no, I don't think China is suicidal. I certainly don't think Xi Jinping is suicidal. If they thought the U.S. will actually come to Taiwan's defense, will start shooting down Chinese planes that are attacking Taiwan, sinking ships in the Taiwan Strait, that means war. It doesn't necessarily mean nuclear war, but it could escalate to nuclear war, and I don't think China, Beijing, wants to take that risk. But they don't see that as a threat right now. They see that they can keep pushing things and getting away with more and more.
Yeah. Now, we're at that time in the show where I like to bring out Bob the Genie. And as I rub my magic lamp and Bob the Genie pops out, Bob grants all guests three wishes. But those wishes have to be related to the topics we've been discussing. So, you know, no great wealth, you know, no eternal youth, none of that stuff. It's got to be things we're talking about. So as Bob grants you wish number one, Joe, what is that wish?
The wish is, as I mentioned, that the United States would issue a policy paper, an official statement, not a random answer to a reporter's question at a hastily convened meeting, but a vetted policy officially declaring the United States, it's in the United States' national interest that Taiwan remain free to decide its own future. And if it decides to join with China, so be it. But there's no chance of that really happening. And that we will defend Taiwan unequivocally. And that's, if we would state that, if in official policy position, that the United States government is committed to the defense of Taiwan, equivalent to a mutual defense treaty, I think we would do much to ease the tensions in the Taiwan Strait.
Yeah, it's I've often wondered, why don't we sort of offer a very clear history of Taiwan? Because China's claims to Taiwan are, you know, illegitimate. Throughout the history of, I'm pretty familiar with the history of Taiwan, and historically, Taiwan was never part of China, Imperial China, Nationalist China, Communist China. It's always been independent. You know, the Dutch have been there, the Japanese, you know, it's been, you know, Hakka pirates. It's been all kinds of things, but it hasn't been part of China and administered by China. And so I wonder why we don't sort of tell this history that, hey, it's not that you're losing something. Taiwan is something you never had. I've never quite understood why that point isn't made sort of more vocally and clearly, such that it pushes back on the PRC's narrative that they want to restore a breakaway province. That's one of the things I've never understood.
I totally agree with you. I think you characterize the history quite accurately, and we need to do that as part of an overall information campaign to China and to Russia and to North Korea, for that matter.
Okay, so now it's time for wish number two. So, Joe, what is that wish?
That we would immediately provide Ukraine with all the weapons it needs to defend itself, as defined by President Zelensky and the Ukrainian government, not as defined by United States officials. We've been withholding, although we've provided lots of help, lots of ammunition, lower level weapons. We've never given them in a timely manner the kinds of weapons that they need, they clearly need. For example, we delayed for many, many months sending them battle tanks. They needed them against the Russian onslaught. We said, no, that would be provocative. This has always been the fallback position. We don't want to provoke Putin because he will escalate. Jet fighters, we've been withholding those. We've been withholding major anti-aircraft systems, air defense systems. All of that should be, we should lift the barriers to those weapon flows. And I think we would see then Ukraine would turn the situation around on the ground and regain the momentum it had until last summer, when our interruption of weapons slowed their counteroffensive and has led to the Russians regaining some territory. So that would be a major wish, and that Biden would drop the idea that doing that is going to be provocative and trigger major escalation by Russia. I don't think Russia has the capacity for a major escalation in Ukraine, short of nuclear weapons, and that's a hollow threat that Biden should disregard and not be intimidated by in the future.
Do you think part of the ration or part of the thinking in terms of not giving Ukraine these systems is that the arsenal of democracy is in part a hollow arsenal, that we just lack the capability because we haven't been keeping the cupboard stocked, and therefore part of it is to just keep the cupboard stocked such that if another war breaks out, we can fight that war? Because I've heard quite a bit of discussion that, you know, we could last about 10 days-ish in a large-scale conflict with China, for example, before, you know, we are, you know, out of munitions and weapons. And so do you think that's part of why we're holding back, or do you think it's a different?
No. I think that is part of it. People, and there are those who support our defense of Ukraine and also support our defense of Taiwan, who argue that we can't do both, that the weapons that we're sending to Ukraine could have been used to a certain extent for the defense of Taiwan, let alone the fact that our own self-defense capabilities might be diminished by the flow of weapons to these other places. But that would have been my third wish that you haven't asked for yet, is that we get ourselves on a more of a, not necessarily a war footing, but a war prevention footing. Reagan said, peace through strength. We need to be stronger. We need to have get up the industrial capacity to provide weapons to those allies and friends who are threatened by aggressive adversaries, as well as to defend ourselves. That means, and it's not just the U.S., the Europeans' defense capabilities have diminished in a major way since the end of the Cold War, and they need to start gearing up as well.
Now, as we end the show, I oftentimes ask our guests to sort of give us your walking away points that you want people to remember 6 months or a year from now.
That we are facing, we are engaged in, we're in the middle of an inflection point in history that decades from now, historians will look back and say that was a period when the West either did or did not, or failed to recognize the multipolar threat coming from loose alliances, loose relationships, strategic relationships, as Xi Jinping and Putin described it, between Russia, China, Iran, and North Korea. There's a flow of weapons. North Korea is providing certain kinds of munitions and drones and so forth to Russia to use in Ukraine. Iran is providing drones. Russia, in return, is providing them with systems that they lack. So we've just got to recognize that we're, sad as it may seem to many, particularly in the younger generation, who don't take war as a given, we are in a war of sorts already, and we've got to prevent it from turning kinetic. And the only way to do that is to show both the ability and the will to resist. And we're failing in certain ways in both domains.
All right. Joe Bosco, thanks for joining us on this episode of NucleCast.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
And thanks to you, the listeners, and we'll see you on the next episode. Well, it's always interesting to talk to one of the graybeards who's been around a while and, you know, seen, you know, 40 plus years of the way things have changed, you know, going back to the Reagan administration and earlier and moving forward. And it gives you a sense of perspective. So having a good conversation with Joe was great. And it always, you know, it feeds that greater understanding and helps you think back at what we ought to do. So hopefully you enjoyed the discussion.
This has been a production of the Anwa Deterrence Center, a 501c3 that seeks to educate key decision makers, stakeholders, and the public to ensure a broader understanding of the nation's strategic nuclear deterrent. Our executive producer is Kimberly Charrington, and this episode has been engineered and mixed by David Grunthal. Help us grow our followers by sharing it and follow the show on LinkedIn, Facebook, and Twitter at NucleCast.